I'll keep. Okay.
I forgot to say something. If you opt in, your faces won't be shown.
Right. Thank you, Monica. Yes. Well, we're off to a jagged start. So good morning. It is September 9th, 2025. And this is our Dharma and Recovery weekly Zoom event. I'm calling it an event to avoid calling it a class. So that's if you're wondering why I'm using that strange terminology. A class would suggest something a little more formal, I think, than what we're doing here. We're going to sit for 20 minutes of meditation and then launch into some reflection. There are people still arriving in the waiting room that we have to click in. Okay, good enough. So I hope everyone is well this morning. As was commented before the recording, we had a little taste of rain in Northern California overnight, which is somewhat early for us in the season, but actually a good sign because it helps to hold off fire events, which I know many of you are quite familiar with. Yeah, how does one stay mindful when not meditating? Jeez, John, give me a, oh, that's for a topic. Oh, good. Thank you. Excellent. There you go. I'll think about that while I'm meditating. Was meditation humor there, such as it is. If
So
it's not,
how the Dharma applies to sobriety?
no, it's in the ch chat, Paolo. It says, oh, that's another topic. How does the Dharma apply to sobriety? Okay. All right, now, come on, you guys. You're overwhelming me. Okay, two topics. Those are good two topics, and they're related. They're interrelated. So let's use them. So okay, let us begin our sitting. Thank you all. This is what happens when I ask for help. I'm like, wait, stop. Right, thank you guys. So beginning just by establishing a comfortable and stable, upright, hopefully upright posture for meditation. I want to be able to sit relatively still. While remaining alert and relaxed. And just having a sense of settling the body. We can apply a certain effort, an unstrained effort, first to settling and calming. And feeling the breath. And you might just imagine, if that's helpful for you, imagine all the energy in your body and your nervous system flowing downward into the earth so that the any stress and tension dissolves. feeling the sensations of breath, either at the nostrils or at the belly. Breathing in, breathing out. Maintaining a balanced energy is critical to meditation, to clarity and mindfulness. And we can gently guide the body and mind. Toward this balance. As you begin to sit, if there's a lot of energy and busyness, just using this calming sense, settling, grounding. And if the calming becomes out of balance and become drowsy or the mind becomes more dull, spacey, then you shift the orientation towards uplifting energy. Again, this can be done with a subtle kind of mix of visualization and body awareness. So just imagining energy moving up the spine and lifting the body, sharpening mind. Oh, part of our practice is to notice as you're sitting, what is the energy like right now? Too much calm, too much uplifting energy. So these are two of the hindrances, the sleepiness and restlessness. And as we become more subtly aware, we can gently apply effort to balancing in this way. Not something we can force or make happen, but often just a little intention setting or inclining of the mind can alter the energetic state. As we sit, it's natural that the mind wanders, keeps generating thoughts. If you can keep a degree of awareness in the body or with the breath, you can just let the thoughts flow through without trying to suppress or abandon them, let them go. If, though, you find you're completely detached from the present moment, lost in thinking, fantasies, plans, memories, then in those times we more intentionally bring the breath, bring the attention back to the breath, and settle back into the body. If there's a really persistent thinking energy happening, then perhaps turn toward the mood or the emotion that's behind the thinking. Oftentimes there's some distress or agitation that's unacknowledged or that we're trying to think our way out of. Mindfulness encourages us to turn toward that mood or mental state, feeling it, breathing with it, allowing it. The non-resistance, the non-aversion can help to hold that with less mental disturbance, less thinking, just breathing with the feelings. Before I get going, just wanted to mention that tonight I will be at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. For anyone in the Bay Area who would like to drop in for an in-person event, 7:30 p.m. 7:30 to 9, we sit for a half hour and then, as usual, Dharma talk and discussion. That group has been growing, so it'd be lovely to have people, anybody who's around who can make it. So a couple of good questions to sort of start us off, but even before I get into that, I want to talk about something that's been that I brought up in the guided meditation and sort of a theme of my practice recently is working with energy in the body. And I just want to give a couple, I'll call these like tips kind of suggestions. And then address the questions. Because as I said in the meditation, like just having a balance of energy between being calm and being alert is really critical to meditation. And typically we are a little out of balance in one way or the other. Often people fall asleep while meditating, or they are very restless and have a hard time just settling. And it's generally, if you just sit, that energy will naturally balance over time. But we can also sort of encourage that, and partly this comes down to posture, which people, I think, sometimes get locked into an idea of like the right posture or the one that feels the best to them, without noticing when it's causing some energetic imbalance. So one of the things that happens is that if you're sitting in a way that lets your shoulders kind of come together and the chest closes a little bit. So like if you put your hands in your lap between the legs, then that tends to cause less breath and then less energy. And that can be helpful if there is, as I said, a lot of restlessness and you really need to calm, to just sort of like let yourself, it's not exactly slumping, but just sort of letting the body soften a little bit. And it might not seem like, oh, I don't look like I'm a, Buddha the way I'm sitting, but that, how we look isn't so important, right? And so then that's the physical. But then, as I was talking about, we can do a kind of visualization, and this works both ways, that we visualize energy moving downward. And again, I wouldn't spend a lot of time with this, and you don't want to get too caught up in it as like trying to control things, but just sort of like, oh, is that available? Is that calming available if I just sort of settle my body and imagine a little bit this energy moving down through the body and into the earth potentially? So this sort of work, and when I'll talk about the other side of that, but this sort of work is common, not so common in Buddhist, mindfulness meditation, but quite common in more Hindu-oriented practices like Kundalini or Kriya yoga, and in fact, Qigong itself is a way of moving energy in this way too, that uses movement, but is really more about the internal experience. So then the other thing, and I bring this up because I've been particularly working with the uplifting energy, because I noticed I was teaching a couple of retreats and I noticed that I was settling really nicely, and then towards the end of every sit I would start to conk out. And so the balancing then is to, I put my hands on my thighs and that opens my chest a little bit, and I lift my head a little bit. And then, just as with the other practice, a calming practice, a little bit of visualizing energy moving upward, and this is much more much of what they do with Kundalini yoga. So working with chakras, which are energy centers, right, in the body. And so, Again, I don't spend like 20 minutes on this. I spend like a minute, but just like a minute to just like, and sometimes I even like imagine like energy coming out of the top of my head, and you can actually combine this with loving kindness meditation, where you're radiating kindness over the entire world. So if you ever do that kind of practice where you're thinking about really spreading love, then you can kind of see it as energy moving up and out. And again, just for a few moments, when you're seeing that your energy is slipping one way or the other, just play with these things. And it's one of those things you just develop some skills with, or a sort of a natural way of working with it. It's not something you want to force by any means, or get make into a central part of your practice, but just as a as something to help you to balance the practice. So let me come to the two questions we got. One was, how does one stay mindful when not meditating? And the other was about how does Dharma help recovery? Of course, that's a very broad topic, but I'll start with the first question, and I'm gonna I'll say that there's a the mistake of this question, John, bless you, is the word stay. So this is where we have to be careful that we're not getting this idea that like, and not that that isn't an ideal, but it's very unlikely that we're going to stay mindful. And when we set that up as a model, then there's a sense of failure sort of built in to the question, to setting ourselves up like, oh, I'm gonna stay mindful all day today. Okay, starting right now. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in. Oh, what am I gonna have for lunch? Oh, I lost it. Oh, I messed it up, So to recognize that really just a few moments of mindfulness in a day are very helpful. Any moment of mindfulness really can actually have a quite powerful impact on the course of your day. So I look for a couple things. One is mindful walking, and this is one of the reasons why practicing mindfulness, mindful walking on retreats is really helpful in this transition. Because it habituates, it starts to set up in the mind a correlation between walking and mindfulness, and so that walking triggers mindfulness. So that's a simple tool to just use, like when you're walking, whether it's down the hall or up the mountain, brief or lengthy, that you just put some attention in the feet. And that doesn't mean that the entire time of taking your hour-long walk or whatever, you're mindful every step, but rather that you catch it a few times. Oh, I'm just walking. And I find like just being outside and we know like being in nature is very evocative of mindfulness, and so just being in nature generally, because all the senses, seeing is a really good mindfulness practice. Just taking a walk, like if you're in a city, taking an architecture walk where you're just walking around. One of the things that's really interesting to me, I only started to notice when I started the meditation, is to look at the top of buildings. Because ordinarily I walk with my head down, right? And when I lift my head, it shifts my and makes me more awake. And then I start to see things that I don't normally see. And that's just, those are moments of mindfulness. So really simple things, routine behaviors like washing the dishes, really good time to just from just oh I'm washing the dishes, just aware that you're doing that, right? So really, that's There's no trick to it. There's no like, oh, here's all you have to do. It's a matter of setting an intention and looking for little moments and trying to find little moments. I don't like the idea of turning it into some big goal. But the third, the next last thing I'll say is that in moments of great stress or emotional disruption, those are really good moments to catch yourself and to go, "Ooh, what am I feeling right now?" And just if there's some shock or some, anger or grieving, something that just hits you, something sad, something upsetting, to just make it a habit to stop and feel your feelings. I mean, feeling emotions. Because, so, I mean, I can spend the whole day, I guess, on this, but, when we start to see what the mind does with our emotions, how it grabs a hold of a feeling and then spins out and creates your day, creates your mood, creates your whole view of like how bad things are, then you start to realize like, oh, like there's two different things. There are emotions and there are thoughts. One doesn't have to lead to the other. We have an emotion and we immediately have this story about it, and then we have fear about it or judgment about it. And that's those fears, those judgments, those stories are not the feeling. And we often, I think, get that confused. We think that they are the same thing, that this feeling is a as we say, feelings aren't facts, right? But that it's a real thing that has to be, it has to be dealt with, And it's like, does it, could I just have this unpleasant feeling and then continue washing the dishes, I mean, there's also, the cognitive behavioral approach, my daughter was spinning out a little about politics yesterday. And, I just started offering her counter arguments to to the story she was making. It's like, yeah, there's really bad things that are happening. And this person is really unpopular. They're doing things that, no, and so, we need those counter arguments. Oh, yeah, that was like if it's personal, right? Like, oh, that was really, I shouldn't have done that. And then going, yeah, but I was trying to do this, or I'm such an idiot. And then, no, wait, I have a master's degree. I couldn't be that stupid. Those kind of logical counter arguments to our what the cognitive behavioral psychologists call cognitive distortions. It's really a great term, cognitive distortion, to realize, oh, what's going on in my mind is I'm distorting reality with my mind. I'm creating a version of it that's not really accurate. And a lot of times it's like, I don't even know if it's accurate. It's not, reality isn't one thing. I can be a jerk and a nice person, like that's just the way it is, right? It's not one thing. I mean, that's not the best example. So, I mean, I think this response leads naturally to Paolo's question about how Dharma and recovery, work together. I was reflecting on this a couple of days ago, on this sort of this very question in a way, like what the role of meditation is in recovery. But that necessarily brings up the question of what's the role of a program. And In very simplistic terms, we could say that like a recovery program, a 12-step program, a recovery dharma or something is first and foremost about behavior. And that dharma practice is more about the mental sphere. So obviously they blend because, the dharma has the precepts and sila and so, morality and ethics, and recovery has, inventories and meditation, prayer. So, but the primary sort of aspect up to me of a recovery program is to restrict my behavior and to get me to behave in a different way. So it creates boundaries. So I'm putting my hands out. I'm like, oh, why are my hands out here? Oh, it's boundaries. Those limits, which the precepts also do, right? But when it's about addiction, it's very, very specific. It's not just, oh, I'm not going to kill any living beings. Not that that's trivial, but I mean, it can get kind of vague. I'm not going to steal. I'm not going to harm sexually, though. Not going to. Actually, not use intoxicants is a good one, but the boundaries of behavior are the core of recovery. But what we realize through Dharma practice is that that behavior is very much guided by the mind, and that the mental state triggers feelings that trigger actions, and that if we're not watching our mind, if we're not careful about our mind states, that we can, that it becomes more difficult to, and at times impossible to maintain the boundaries, because those boundaries are dependent upon, to some extent, our willpower. And our willpower gets undermined when our mental states become unwholesome, to use the classic Buddhist term. We say, oh, I'm not going to do that. And then we get more and more upset or more and more agitated or more and more, craving shows up or anger or whatever it is. And then it's like, oh, screw it, and so. So the practice of Dharma not only helps us to see those mental states, but to, generate more wholesome states through the meditative practices, through mindfulness, through concentration, through loving kindness, through compassion. So we're And this is the word that the Buddha uses. We're training the mind. We're trying to train the mind so it doesn't get into these states that will threaten the boundaries that we've set up with our recovery program. And so those two really go hand in hand. If you just have this mental practice, like I meditate a lot, but you don't have boundaries of behavior, well, the meditation won't protect you because you don't have, rules. You're not setting up any boundaries for your behavior, and it's easy to lapse. I mean, that was certainly the way I operated early in my Buddhist practice before I got sober. I meditated a lot, and I could get into these mind states, but I did. But my behavioral stuff was not bounded, or there was no training going on that end. I like the word training because that aspect of creating habits. I mean, addiction is a one form of habit, right? A really unhealthy habit. We have to create new habits. It's one of the sort of cliches of recovery, but we create new habitual behavioral patterns, and we create new habitual mental patterns. And all of that tends to work together to reinforce and strengthen the recovery process so that it becomes less and less likely that you'll break those structures because they're no longer really part of your way of operating. They're not how you think. They're not how you act, and they're not even how you see the world. You know, as an addict, you see the world in a certain way, as this not contest, but struggle to maintain your high without, wrecking your life, kind of. And anything that allows that to happen is okay, right? That's kind of those are the boundaries. And when we sh have this complete shift in orientation toward, no, I don't do those things. Not only do I not do those things, I do these other things. Then those habitual patterns become much more wholesome, and they become very difficult to break. As I think it becomes less and less likely that there's relapse. So that was an attempt to be helpful around those questions. I don't know if it was sufficient, but it's what I have for now. So I appreciate you listening, and we have plenty of time left for questions or comments. Hi, Anne, go ahead.
Hey, no,
Hi.
just as you were talking, I'm like, did you say? What I heard was, well, I heard a lot of, but bound precepts is boundaries.
Yeah.
Why haven't I heard that before? It makes so much. I don't know. I am hearing it now, and I think it's really cool. And it also reminds me of like this idea of, fierce compassion is boundary setting for yourself.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
When I'm on a track of doing harm of some sort in my head or out in my behavior or my intention, I see it's painful, it hurts, so I'm more likely to let it go, or at least bring
Yeah.
compassion to it. But setting boundaries is it's a very compassionate thing to do. I mean, for yourself and then
Yeah.
too. Oh, yeah, that's cool. I just really heard that in a way that
Yeah.
landed.
Yeah, it's funny how those things are, right? Like, it's not a shocking revelation or anything, but
No.
it's just like, oh, it's a nice connection. It's like, because it's like it's using the kind of recovery
Modern,
language to talk about the Dharma. And
right.
yeah. But yeah, I mean, the precepts are also called protectors, right? They're part of the kind of Hiri and Otapa
Right.
aspect, right? They
Right.
protect us, and they protect the world from harm. And
That's the.
that's the compassion of that Anālya talks about, that
Yeah.
precepts being an act of compassion for the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for yourself, I really believe it begins with. I know. I yeah. I yeah. It's both and.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. See you soon.
Okay, good. Steve.
Good morning, Kevin.
Hi.
I was thinking back at the talk you gave. Oh gosh, it was quite a while ago, but it was talking about when you were shifting positions in the middle of your meditation and to help you achieve more clarity and more concentration. And two things that have been going on for me now is that different Buddhist traditions, in my mind, long ago, I used to think I had to be very rigid with my sitting and had to not move, or you're going to get smacked in the back of your head with a stick or something, And so since I've extended my meditation time over this past year, I have found that Shifting my posture and or maybe even turning my head a little bit or anything really kind of reawakened me to what I was doing is in terms of meditation. And the other thing that it's helped me with is, again, going back to the idea that I've extended my meditations, is I used to have these grand expectations. I always had these ideas that I was going to have something happen. And now I've really learned on a deep level to what's going to happen is going to happen. I have no control over it, nor do I even want control over it. And when something comes in that's negative or creates angst within me, I just let it go and just keep breathing. And sometimes I'll change my breathing pattern. That helps me get back out of that negative thinking process. But the idea of moving and shifting the posture has been very beneficial for me. So thanks for speaking to that.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. And I mean, the key thing is maintaining mindfulness, particularly in movement. If you're feeling restless or uncomfortable and you're just kind of moving around trying to find a comfy way to sit, then there's a grasping happening and there isn't awareness. But if you're sitting still and then you realize, oh, this is starting to become too uncomfortable for me to really stay present with, then you intentionally move and you kind of, you're like, okay, I'm going to move. And then you move and as you're moving, you're aware of movement, just as you would be aware of in Qigong movement, or walking meditation. You're just aware of like, okay, I'm tipping or I'm leaning or I'm straightening. And then you're aware of coming back into stillness. And then you check in, well, what changed now? Noticing the change in sensation, presumably if there was a discomfort, then now there's some ease that comes. So you notice that. So to stay with that whole process, so it's not just something that's happening without awareness or restlessness.
Right, and that's what's been happening. Thanks for bringing that up because that's exactly what happens. Because when you sit for an hour and a half, or whatever, like I do every morning, I think it's a natural occurrence. And so, exactly what you just explained is what I've been doing. It's been really helping.
Beautiful. Very good. Thanks, Steve. Wilson, hello.
Hello. Thanks for today. I'm pretty new to this. I just got out of rehab
Okay.
a few weeks ago. After first time in rehab, I've been trying to get sober for about 15 years. I'm really struggling. And it's a couple things. I'm not having cravings for alcohol, but I'm having really severe cravings for other things. And I'm recognizing that because I was so focused on alcohol, I wasn't really focusing on the other cravings that I've had for a long time, and they're showing up really strong right now.
Right.
And the other thing that's been really, really hard is that coming out of rehab, and I consider myself still in recovery. I'm in a sober living house, and I have a calendar of that I do every day of meditation and going to Dharma meetings and AA, and exercise. So I consider myself very much in recovery, and focusing on that as my number one priority. But I'm having, and I had a real sense of like I'm doing really good up until about a week ago. And then what I've noticed is that I'm having really, I'm having a really, really hard time focusing on anything. Do like anything at all, to the point where I know I need to get a document printed. So I go online to sign up for it, and the next thing I know, I'm doing something else. And I've
Right.
completely forgotten about the thing I'm doing. And then when I go to do the other thing, I'm going to do the next thing. I literally cannot, I can't I mean, I immediately think of just like severe ADD, but like I can't focus, and I wake up in the morning just con like with that being my existence. It's really troubling.
So, a couple things. One, I just want to let you know, I don't know if you were noticing the chat, but there we do have a contact list that where you might find some folks with some experience who might be able to just sort of not necessarily sponsor you, but be like a Dharma buddy here through this difficult time. So if you go in there, I would, that's one suggestion. But as for what's going on, first of all, if you can, I know it can be hard to accept this, to realize that if you're not using one day at a time, you're doing well. And the mental states, the disruption, the lack of attention, all kinds of states, moods, and then the external problems as well. But the internal ones are just, that's kind of the deal. You have to, you can't really solve those things. You're not gonna get all that straightened out after a couple weeks or even a couple months. It takes time. There's a healing, a fairly lengthy healing process that has to happen. And this is why it's so hard to get through the opening months, because there's a reason why. I mean, we were living one way, and having this escape valve of our addiction, and that's gone. And now we have to face all the struggles of just being a human being, plus we have to deal with the damage we've done to ourselves and sometimes to the world. So just showing up, and the fact that you're here, to me, is a success. Okay. So I think it's really important to keep that in mind, because everything is telling, pushing you that it's bad, right? And so when it comes to other cravings, this is also part of the process, which is that you remove the primary addiction, and it turns out that that primary addiction was not the problem, and so now you're faced with, the problems of being a human being who is a, we are, we're not the most, emotionally healthy, mature beings, this group of addicts, and we have to somehow learn to contain all these energies and not let the next addiction turn into a real problem. It's just so there's an aspect of this early process that is just about, can I tolerate this? And whether you want to call it pain or anxiety or craving, can I tolerate this and not act out? Can I get through this? And every time you don't act out, you're strengthening that capacity to not relapse every day. That's what we're building up. That's the training I'm talking about. You're training yourself in a new way of being. And it's a battle. It's like you're 200 pounds overweight and you got to go to the gym every day and try, and you're like, fuck it, I don't want him to move anymore. It's a, this is the classic battle between addiction and recovery. And you're in the middle of it. And I appreciate you're in a sober living house. That's the right thing. You've got a routine. You're focusing on taking care of yourself, going to meetings, exercise, and you still have this addict brain and body and craving that it's a cliche that is absolutely true, which is it will get better, but it just requires it not just it's not a little thing. It requires us to walk through these fires, and nobody can do it for you, but I'm happy to see that in the chat several people have like offered their phone numbers, and so we are trying to help. We do help each other, and that's the main thing. I mean, that's the main tool we have is our community and the support, and just to fill up those hours and get through the days, and day by day, week by week, month by month, and then we get, I mean, the miracle. I hate that. I don't like that kind of language because it's not a miracle. That's like saying somebody broke the 100-yard dash record and it was a miracle. No, they just worked their ass off to get there, and that's what we're doing here. So appreciate you showing up. I appreciate you speaking up. And it's not always easy, in a group that you don't know people, and to be vulnerable. So you're doing everything right, man.
Thank you. Thanks, Kevin.
We appreciate you being here. Just I'm loving the chat, we're kind of out of time here, so that's a great Wilson, thank you for being the last person to check in, because we all appreciate what you're going through and your honesty. That's our bottom line. So I will mention one other thing, that promotion-wise, that this Friday is my Spirit Rock class, 6 p.m. Pacific. And that's been shrinking. So if you want to come to a nice small group, come to that. Maybe then it'll get bigger, but otherwise I will see everybody next Tuesday. Don't drink or use no matter what. Take care of yourself. Peace.
No sugar either.
Oh, well, okay, Steve. All right. Don't be, that's for you, though. We don't.
I know. All right. Thanks, Kevin.
All
See you
right, Steve,
later.
take care. Steer you away from that pumpkin pie, man.
I know. Go away.
That moment stands in memory. All right, folks.
Steve, I'm sorry.
Oh, uh-oh. Well, he left. That's good. You're
Okay, good.
going to trigger him,
Because
Jamie.
I know.
All right, I'm ending the
Bye-bye.
meeting. Bye.
Okay, bye.